This is Jacqueline Pillsbury on June 19th at the Princeton Public Library as part of the Voices of Princeton project. I'm here today with interviewee Bernie Miller and interviewer Ruth Miller.
I'm Ruth Miller.
Hello, I'm Bernie Miller.
Ruth is the interviewer and Bernie is the interviewee.
So, what brought you to the Princeton area?
I came to the Princeton area in 1957 to go to work at the RCA Labs. And I was attracted to the job at the RCA Labs because I got very little detail about the nature of the job, other than the fact that it was a satellite project for the U.S. Army. And this was well before Sputnik, and I was intrigued by the idea of satellites, having studied a bit about the possibility of launching something into space when I was a graduate student. And although the job at the RCA lab wasn't fully defined to me before I started work, because it required a security clearance, which mine had lapsed when I left the military, I soon understood exactly what it was after I started work.
So you brought your family, your then family, to live in Princeton. Was it what you expected, or was it different?
Well, I had been to Princeton for an interview at the RCA Labs before accepting the job, and had an opportunity to see what the town, at least the downtown part of the town, looked like. A little bit about the residential areas of town, trying to figure out where I might find housing with my family when I moved here. And it was during the summertime when I finally came to start work, and classes weren't in session, and Princeton was a lot quieter than it was when I came for my interview during the time when the classes were in session during the academic year.
So it was a pretty quiet little town during that summer.
It was. I had come from Annapolis, which was the capital of the state of Maryland, and it quieted down during the summertime as well, because the midshipmen at the Naval Academy, where I'd been teaching, basically left during the summer. And the campus at the Naval Academy was pretty quiet during the summer months. St. John's campus was also quiet year-round. But I liked the atmosphere of a college town, and that was one of the things that appealed to me about living in Princeton.
So how do you think Princeton has changed? What year was that?
That was 1957.
Okay, so how has Princeton changed since then, particularly over the summertime?
Well, summertime in Princeton in the 1950s and into the 1960s was very quiet. I used to think in the evening, you could get a bowling ball and roll it down Nassau Street and not hit anything. It has changed. When I moved to Princeton, parking in the downtown, particularly during the summer months, was not an issue. Stores were not crowded. Restaurants were not crowded. There certainly was not the number of what you'd call good restaurants then as there is now. I think Lierre's was about the only restaurant that would fit the category of let's go out to dinner at a white tablecloth restaurant, and now there are several.
So where did you and your family go out to eat?
We went out mainly to there weren't fast food places at that time, mm-hmm. but there were a couple of sort of pizza places and the places that would appeal to to kids, and my kids were young at that point, on Nassau Street. I think Balt was one of them, and there was another one that had a jukebox, and my kids liked to go there, and they had a kid-friendly menu, and they'd like to drop quarters in the jukebox and play music.
Mm-hmm. What was the most difficult time for you in Princeton?
Well, transitioning from being an officer in the Air Force to being a civilian was difficult. I had been on active duty for 7 years in the Air Force, shortly after I started work at the RCA Labs on the satellite project, the Army notified RCA that its funding had been rescinded by the government and that we were to complete what we were doing, box up all the work, and ship it to the Army at Huntsville by the end of the fiscal year. I thought, hey, I've made a real mistake by taking this job. Had I stayed in the Air Force, my next assignment probably would have been the Air Force's space program out on the West Coast. And here I've taken a job with RCA, and I may be looking for a new job in a couple of months. Fortunately, along came the Russians with Sputnik, and the things went from let's wrap this job up and close it out to how much money can you spend, how quickly can you spend it, how fast can you get a satellite built.
And what about your family at that time?
Well, I'm not sure much of this affected the family as much as it did me. I didn't go back home and say, hey kids and wife, we may have to pack up and move someplace else.
Right, but your marriage was obviously affected by the work.
My marriage was affected by the work because what I was working on was considered to be classified, which meant I could not discuss it with either my wife or kids. Mm-hmm. And as far as they were concerned, I went to work in the morning, came home in the evening, and couldn't talk much about what I was doing at work.
And what did your kids think you did?
Well, it's funny. My kids thought I worked in a candy factory because I used to carry a pack of chewing gum around with me all the time. And I had it in my shirt pocket. I'd come home and empty it out, and the kids would see me empty out the chewing gum from my shirt pocket. And one of my kids particularly came to the conclusion that there was a never-ending supply of chewing gum where I worked, and it must have been a candy factory.
So tell me about how your marriage ended and you remarried. How did that all play out? You don't have to give all the lurid details.
Well, I was married for the first time when both my then wife and I were very young. I was a second lieutenant in the Air Force.
And how old was she?
I was 21, and she was, I believe, 19 at the time. We had been engaged off and on for a couple of years. We had dated for a number of years before that, and we got married. I was in uniform when we got married. We had a 1 or 2 day honeymoon in New York, and then drove to Ohio, where I was stationed at the time. And neither of us had been west of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it was all new to her. I had been in Ohio, stationed in Ohio, prior to getting married, so I knew what I was going to, but it was a big change for her, and we were living in a tiny apartment on the second floor of sort of Cape Cod house, and the apartment consisted of a galley kitchen, a bedroom, sitting room, and a bathroom.
So, but the marriage ended in Princeton, right?
The marriage ended in Princeton. It ended, if I were to try and put my finger on the cause, the ending of the marriage, it ended because by then we were both very different people than we were mm-hmm. when we got married. The Air Force had sent me to graduate school. I had done work, fairly sophisticated work for the Air Force, including travel outside of the U.S., and my then wife was not interested in education, not very interested in travel, and I don't think very interested in what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe Princeton to someone who has never been here?
Well, depends upon when I would try to describe Princeton. If I were to try to describe Princeton
today.
Today I would say Princeton is what in England would be described as a market town. In other words, a regional attraction with a world-class university as part of the regional attraction. And a town where there is a wide variety of people, ethnically, racially, economically, and a wide variety of opportunities that present themselves for education, for entertainment, a wide variety of opportunities for food, and a wide variety of opportunities for recreation. It is a great town in which to live. It is a great town in which to raise children, except that children can come to the conclusion very easily that every place is like Princeton, and it's not. And it's a bit precious in that respect.
What made you decide to go into politics?
A number of things did. First of all, I have always had an interest in politics. I had an interest in politics as an undergraduate at Penn State. I participated in the organization of a new student political party as an undergraduate at Penn State. And then was junior class secretary treasurer, elected junior class secretary treasurer, and elected senior class vice president. Politics there was campus politics. The interest was not nationally, although there were things going on campus that mirrored the national environment, including issues of social justice. And it was interesting, an interesting time, in that there were issues such as where could black students find accommodations in town? Where could they have simple things like get their hair cut in town? There were barbers that refused to cut the hair of blacks, and the political party that I helped to found fought against that kind of thing, fought against racial discrimination. Penn State, in my junior year, was invited to play in a bowl game for the first time in a number of years in Texas. And there was a big furor over the fact that Penn State at the time had a couple of black players on the team, just a few. But the Cotton Bowl, people that ran the Cotton Bowl said that the black players could not stay at the same hotel with the white players. They had to stay at a hotel for black people. And we pushed the administration at Penn State to push back on the Cotton Bowl, saying either the team stayed together in one hotel or they got somebody else to play against SMU in the Cotton Bowl. And the team voted that the team would stay together in one hotel, backed up the position, and they did stay in one hotel.
Now, did all that motivate you to get involved in politics in Princeton? You wouldn't have seen the same issues, I assume.
No, I didn't see the same issues that clearly when I moved to Princeton. I really didn't get involved in politics in Princeton until I had been here for probably close to 6 or 7 years. And
who influenced you to get involved in politics?
I was attracted to Jim Floyd's campaign when Jim Floyd was running for township committee. And I thought Jim was a bit charismatic, that he had some interesting ideas. And I worked on his campaign, and Jim was elected. I didn't run for office until much after that.
Did you get involved in consolidation efforts at all?
Yes. The first time I got involved in consolidation was in the 1970s when Jay Blyman was mayor of the township, Jay had been mayor of the township, and Jay asked me to work with him on a consolidation study commission, and I did the economic analysis, or part of the economic analysis, for consolidation. Consolidation in the 1970s was voted down, as it was in the 1980s and the 1990s. It was a case of not three strikes and you're out, but three strikes and the next time up you hit home run, and consolidation passed in 2012.
So what was that the biggest event you can remember happening in Princeton, or were there other things that were major events here to do with the university or to do with a town?
Well, there are two things that really stand out to me. And one was how the town came together after 9/11 at Palmer Square, when many hundreds of people gathered after 9/11, and there was a ceremony, and
was that mostly
it was moving
grief, or was it
no
ethnic? Was it to do with racial issues?
It wasn't that. It was to do with unity, mm-hmm. in the face of something that none of us really understood at the time. That stands out to me as something that will persist in my memory for a long time. And then consolidation. Having worked on it a couple of times before, and finally arriving at a point where we could see a way through to bring about consolidation, and having played a role in bringing it about. Also, is something that I'll remember for a long time.
What do you think of as some of your other accomplishments since you have been involved in local government?
Well, my first involvement after I worked on the Consolidation Study Commission in the 1970s was in the 1980s when I served on Princeton Township's Affordable Housing Board.
As a volunteer?
As a volunteer. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Princeton Township was engaged in building Griggs Farm. And in the middle of the development of Griggs Farm, the housing market collapsed. The financial support for Griggs Farm dried up, and the township had to take over the project, bond it, and see it through to completion. And I was on the housing board when all of that happened. From there, I was asked to serve on the Joint Cable TV Committee. Someone concluded that since I had worked on satellites that took pictures and relayed them back to Earth, that I knew something about cable TV, which I didn't, but asked me to take on the Cable TV Committee. I served on the committee, became chair of the Cable TV Committee, and headed the negotiations with RCN that led to the rebuilding of our cable system. If you go back to the 1970s, Princeton had a rather archaic cable TV system. It had been built as a showcase by Dow Jones when they thought they were going to go into the cable business. They didn't. And it was a system that had a limited number of channels. They sold it to RCN. RCN made all sorts of commitments about rebuilding the system, which they never did. And finally, when I was chair of the Cable TV Committee, we invited RCN to come to a meeting with the Cable TV Committee here in Princeton. We invited the Board of Public Utilities to send someone down to the meeting. The Board of Public Utilities did. We taped the meeting to show it on our own cable system. And we got the lawyer from RCN to say, we will rebuild this cable system and it will be done in 1 year. A year later, nothing had happened. We repeated the invitation to RCN to come to a meeting with the Cable TV Committee, BPU to come down also, and we replayed the tape from the previous year where RCN's attorney said, don't worry, it'll be rebuilt in less than a year. BPU immediately turned around and said to RCN, rebuild the cable system. RCN then sold the cable system to Patriot Media. Patriot Media rebuilt the system, and it's what we have today. I also had the fun of negotiating the franchises with, at that point, RCN, then Patriot Media, which set up the financial mechanism to fund our local, what are called public, educational, and governmental channels as part of the franchise. And through that franchise, we have well-funded public television in Princeton.
Let me go back a few years to your career in aerospace and tell me how it felt when you were named NASA Man of the Year.
I don't think I was ever named NASA Man of the Year.
Well, that's what Town Topics said you were named.
That's a case of don't believe everything you read in the newspaper. In 1961, I became manager of a project called Ranger. And the goal of Ranger was to take the first close-up pictures of the moon from space. It was started before the Apollo program, and once the Apollo program got underway, the nature of the Ranger project was changed to take close-up pictures of prospective landing sites for the Apollo capsule on the moon. I took over the program after there had been 5 consecutive failures with Ranger, most of them associated with failures of the launch vehicle one way or the other. I took it over. The 6th launch was a success from the standpoint of the launcher working properly. However, when we got to the vicinity of the moon and we gave the command to turn television on, the television didn't work. We then had a congressional investigation, major failure investigations, and it turned out that once again there had been a problem with the launch vehicle where there had been electrical arcing from the engines that are jettisoned from the Atlas launcher back to the mainframe of the Atlas, and the arcing was picked up by cabling in the satellite, and the high voltage surge fried the electronics in the satellite. We fixed that. Ranger 7, 8, and 9 were all great successes. They were carried on national television. And when the project was over, NASA recognized my role in the project by conveying on me the NASA Public Service Award for management of the Ranger project. Somehow or another, I think it was Town Topics, got onto this and featured me on the front page of Town Topics with what I think you called Man of the Year. It was probably Man of the Week.
So, you and I got married in 1973. We met in Princeton, and you adopted my 2 children. So, how does it feel to have 6 children all of a sudden?
Interesting. By the time you and I met, my 2 oldest children from the first marriage, well, the oldest child had really gone off on his own. He was interested in music from the time he was an infant, toddler. And had gone off on his own to pursue a career in music. And my oldest daughter was, I think, a junior in high school at the time. So,
in college, I think.
No, I think she was in private high school at the time.
Oh.
Someplace called House in the Pines. Mm-hmm. And she was there because she had a laissez-faire attitude about the Princeton High School, which involved walking in the front door and walking out the back door, and then going over to the campus and taking part in demonstrations against IDA on campus. She got shipped off to a private school.
IDA.
Institute for Defense Analysis, mm-hmm. on campus, where the students were demonstrating against having what they considered to be part of the military-industrial complex on campus.
Mm-hmm.
She went off to a private high school, finished up there, and then went off to the University of San Francisco. And how did it feel to have
6 children?
6 children. Well, you know, there were never really 6 children around at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
There were occasionally, frequently four, sometimes five, particularly after my daughter came back from her adventures off on the West Coast and in Idaho and lived with us very briefly. But there was never six kids at one time. And even now, it is very rare for us to get the six kids together because they all live in different places. They all pursue different careers.
So my kids were quite a bit younger than your kids. Did it feel like having a second family somehow?
It did. It did, but except that my youngest kid from my first marriage and our oldest child from our marriage are only about 18 months apart. And they got on quite well. And then the youngest child from our marriage is even younger and didn't really get in the mix that much at that point.
They were at elementary school in Princeton. And one of them thought that you disappeared to Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, which was actually... Tell that story.
Well, when I got separated from my first wife, I bought a house in West Windsor and was living there by myself. And then when you and I met, the guy who became my youngest son when I adopted him had some strange conception about where I went, because I was doing business with Battelle in Columbus, Ohio at the time, and used to go to meetings in Columbus, and he came to the conclusion that when we went out to West Windsor to my house, that was Columbus, Ohio. And used to talk about, we'll go to Columbus, Ohio, and we'd get in the car and drive out to West Windsor. That was only for a short period of time, though.
Has Princeton ever frustrated or disappointed you?
Sure. Sure, a couple of times on consolidation votes. When I first ran for office in the 1970s and lost convincingly, sure. Those were frustrating experiences. Has the town frustrated me? I don't think so. I mean, it was frustrating the work on a consolidation campaign and lose in one instance, I think, by less than 50 votes. It was an education to run for office the first time and lose very convincingly to two incumbents. So, frustration, not really.
And then you ran and won.
Then in 2002, I ran.
So how long did you spend as an elected official in local government in Princeton?
15 years.
So
as a member of Princeton Township Committee, as deputy mayor in the township, as mayor in the township, on the Consolidation Study Commission, and then elected to as a member of council for the Consolidated Community, and then retired December 31st, 2017. So a total of 15 years.
And what what would you regard as, what did you enjoy most about working to manage or to be an elected official for Princeton?
Because of my education background in engineering, primarily in engineering, and getting a little smattering of business and public policy when RCA sent me off to Cornell for a summer program, I thought of myself as being a pragmatic person, and pragmatic in the sense of working to find a way to get the job done. And when I look back on major accomplishments that I believe I had a major role, a good role in, a large role in, as a member of Township Committee or as a member of Princeton Council for the Consolidated Municipality, the first has to be the new community park pool, which was built. It took about 2 years to move it through both the Borough Council and the Township Committee, with some members of the Borough Council saying, why do we need a pool? Not every community has a pool. We had a pool, and the pool was a great success, but it had outlived the technology that we used to build a pool, and we had to find a way to finance the construction of the new pool. And I believe that I played a major role in that. Consolidation, of course, I see as a major achievement. I can't claim with that or other things I worked on that I did it by myself. It was, as always, a team effort, and it involved convincing others of the need to do it. And then finally, leading the effort to get the first renewable energy project, solar energy project in Princeton, completed during my final year on council for the Consolidated Municipality. And it is still the only solar energy project in Princeton, and it's successful.
What about town-gown relations? How do you think Princeton Municipality and Princeton University get along? Past, present, and future.
Past, the relationship was not good. One of the other things I can point to as an achievement was the fact that, along with another member of council, we negotiated a multi-year agreement with the university, for the university to provide voluntary funds to the municipality. And that agreement expires this year. That was held up as a major example of how a university and the host municipality can work together, with both parties recognizing that they've got to exist together, coexist in the same space, and that they've got to work together. They have common goals. That improved the relationship between the town and Princeton University. And what happens next remains to be seen.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add about Princeton and you?
About Princeton and me. Well, in the time that I've lived here, my children have participated in various Princeton institutions. My kids took part in programs at the Y. My kids took part in demonstrations against IDA instead of going to class in high school. My kids benefited from the public library. They benefited from the pool. They benefited from Nassau Swim Club.
Mm-hmm.
They benefited from youth sports programs, soccer and baseball.
And you?
And me. I benefited from watching them grow and become functional adults. And I think that the environment in town and the opportunities in town had a lot to do with that. I benefited directly from the university. One of the first things I did when I came here was to recognize the fact that there was a great department of what was then aeronautical engineering at Princeton University. And even though I had gone to graduate school as an Air Force officer at the Air Force Institute of Technology, that some of the stuff that I had read about in textbooks was actually being done at Princeton University. And I was able to convince the powers that be at RCA to give me time off to go to take graduate classes at the university, which I did for 2 years. And that helped my work at RCA and helped me.
And how about the library?
Well, I was invited to join the Friends Council at the library and eventually became treasurer of the Friends. And with the help of a great number of people on the council, we managed to move the Friends' benefit from what was perceived as kind of a white glove social event into an event to raise more than $100,000 a year for the library.
Mm-hmm. So that's been that was a reward.
That was rewarding. Mm-hmm. And I also, when I was mayor, was a trustee
of the library.
Yes. The library for 2 years.
Right. Okay. What else would you like to add?
Well, I'm not sure what else I would like to have. I think living in Princeton has been a great experience, and I think it would have been very difficult for me to match the benefits of living in this town with living in any other town. Even Annapolis, Maryland did not have the opportunities for music, for theater, for lectures open to the public, as they are at Princeton University. And I availed myself of all of that, and that made my life very different. It's also, well, I won't say easy to get into New York, but given
possible
to get into New York if New Jersey Transit continues to operate. Mm-hmm. And you can take advantage of what New York City has to offer. Take advantage of the better parts of what New York City has to offer.
Princeton has been described as or has won awards for ease of living here for an aging population. I think that's what it's called. Do you have thoughts about how the Senior Resource Center fits into the lives of elderly people in Princeton?
I do. In fact, I've worked with the director of the Senior Resource Center on an effort that led to Princeton being recognized as an age-friendly community, and have continued to offer my services to her to help in that respect. But from a personal standpoint, your father moved here when he was 90. And while he didn't take advantage of the facilities of the Senior Resource Center, he did take advantage of some of the services mm-hmm. of the Senior Resource Center. Princeton is a good town in which to live, whether you're a kid or whether you're an adult. It can be more difficult as you age because public transportation is not what it could be, and a large number of people who lived in Princeton for all their adult life wind up moving out of Princeton when they get into their 80s or older because it becomes more difficult for them to take advantage of what the town has to offer.
Do you think it would help if Princeton had an assisted living facility or a continuing care facility in town? Do you think people would stay here to go to something like that?
Well, Princeton does have an assisted living an assisted living facility, Acorn Glen, but it's not large. I think that more people might stay in town if there was a way that they could avail themselves of the downtown and the library and the Senior Resource Center and things that the university has to offer. The difficulty comes about in transportation. I mean, I'm 89. I can still drive, fortunately, and get to where I want to go to. I can still walk pretty well and get to where I want to go to. I don't ride a bike, so you're not going to see me in one of the bike lanes, but the whole issue of transportation becomes a larger issue as you age. And
you don't think the freebie solves that problem?
I think the freebie it provides a very limited solution to the problem. It really doesn't solve the problem. And I think Princeton, like the state of New Jersey and like the country, is going to face the fact that probably the largest growing the part of our population that's going to grow the most is the over 65 part of our population. And towns have started to make accommodations for elderly people. Princeton has made a few, but I think of necessity we'll have to make more in the future.
Do you think group homes are the thing or not really?
Well, I don't know what you mean by a group home, but Princeton does have a number of group homes, but they're primarily for people who are either physically or intellectually mm-hmm. disabled. I think you mean something else by that.
I do, I don't know what you call them.
Co-living facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was going to add something else to my thinking about Princeton in the future. At the present time, Princeton is trying to sort out what it will do in the way of affordable housing for the next decade or so. And while I think that the town eventually will provide affordable housing and probably provide more than the minimum required amount of affordable housing, what's happening in the town is the hollowing out of what I call middle-class housing. When I came to Princeton in 1957, I could buy a house for roughly 2.5 times my annual salary. I can't conceive of somebody who is 27 or 28 years old coming to Princeton and starting a job with one of with the university or with one of the pharmaceutical companies in the area, and being able to buy a house in Princeton for 2 to 2.5 times their annual salary. That means that people who are young and are starting a family wind up living outside of town because they can buy a house there and not stretch themselves by taking on a very large mortgage. But I think what we've got to be careful of is that we don't turn out to be a community that has wealth at one end and affordable housing at the other end. If you look in the real estate section of our local papers, it's rare to see a house that's advertised for less than $1 million. And if it's advertised for less than $1 million, you've probably got to spend several hundred thousand dollars to make it habitable for you. I've often called that Princeton moving toward being a dumbbell community as far as housing is concerned. Affordable at one end, housing available only to the upper 10% on the other end, and no middle class housing. And that manifests itself in the fact that volunteerism drops off. Our volunteer fire company suffers. It's great that the university supports it by releasing their people during the daytime, where they have blue-collar people who are trained as firefighters to work with our volunteers. It's great that students volunteer to serve on our first aid and rescue squad. But without a middle class in Princeton, people whose career is associated with wealth don't seem to volunteer as much as people who are in the middle. And I think that's something that Princeton has to watch out for. If we lose the middle class, we will lose the character, an important element of the character of the town.
I think that's pretty much everything that I want to ask. What did I miss?
What did you miss? How did we meet?
How did we meet?
We met in my ex-wife's driveway.
Well, you describe it.
Well, I was in West Windsor, and I had two of my kids with me for a weekend. Two of the kids from the first marriage with me for a weekend. The two older kids nominally lived with me, but at that point, my older daughter was off at the private school. My older son was off pursuing his career in music, and neither of them were around much. So the two younger kids were with me. My youngest son from first marriage was not feeling very well, wanted to go back to his bedroom in his mother's house. My older son had taken my car and had gone off with my car and left me with his car, which was a beat-up old VW convertible, and with his dog for the weekend. And I loaded dog, five-year-old kid?
Seven, I think.
Maybe seven, into the back of the VW, top-down, and proceeded back to his mother's house. Pulled into the driveway, and there was a woman walking down the driveway with a little child in tow. A dog leaped out of the car, started to bark and chase the woman and the child. And the woman turned to me and said, "Can't you get your goddamn dog under control?" That was the meeting. And we were married, what, 6 months later?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Soon to be 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Thank you again for your time. This is the end of the recording.